Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
Every year we give more and more and more, and we're still underperforming. Throwing money at this is not going to fix it.
This was a line that was said yesterday from one of the members of the ordinance committee. Ultimately, last night, things did not go the way that many people who were rallying to see a higher education budget in Stratford. It didn't go the way that they wanted. The ordinance committee last night voted 5-4 along party lines to send what is now the proposed budget to the town council. And they will have a special meeting tomorrow night at 5:30 on this with council chambers. And I wanted to talk about this and understand a little bit more the significance of this proposed budget and what it could mean, reading about things like staffing cuts and potentially losing a school. I wanted to learn more. So this morning, I welcome to the show Michael Fiorello, who is the president of the Stratford Education Association, but also a teacher in Stratford. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a very important issue to us.
And what was your reaction to even just that opening soundbite that you heard?
Well, I was unsurprised, but I am disturbed by it. I don't think anyone can look at the Stratford schools and think that we need less, that we need less money, that we need fewer teachers, that we need fewer course offerings. I don't get it. I don't see it the same way at all.
So you don't think it's a management issue? You think this truly is a funding issue?
I do think it's a funding issue. Education is expensive. Special education is expensive. Educating students in the 21st century is expensive. And yes, I know taxpayers don't always like to hear it, but it is true that we have to fund our schools here. We can't rely on state funding and federal funding to do the job that the town should do.
So I keep hearing thrown around that a potential school closing could happen if this current budget that's being proposed goes through. Which school? How is that even possible? Is that true?
Well, it was stated by the superintendent that that school closing was on the table. He did not mention the name of a school in his. He wrote a letter to all staff members, and he said that layoffs, if what happened last night came to pass, that staff layoffs of both teachers, administrators, and non-certified staff were on the table, but also a school closing. We don't know the name of which school is being considered, but any school closing is devastating to the town.
And as far as staffing cuts, I mean, that's really significant as well. We've seen that, unfortunately, in some other school districts, especially since COVID. Any idea, any indication how many people and what roles would be cut?
The number we've heard is the possibility of 35 staff members losing their job. We don't know the proportion of teachers, support staff, or administrators. But in order to make up different gaps have been mentioned, but in order to make up over $1 million, it's going to hit a lot of places very hard. We already have large class sizes. Students are already falling through the cracks, and I don't think we can afford to do that.
Mike Fiorello is here, the president of the Stratford Education Association and also a teacher in Stratford. Mike, have they done this before where there's a proposed school education, I should say, budget, and it's much less than what was initially proposed? Has this happened in recent years?
It has happened. The gap hasn't been as large as these two numbers. What was requested by the Board of Ed and what was passed by the Ordinance Committee of the Town Council is rather large this year. It has happened in the past, and we have faced layoffs in the past. Nothing to the numbers that we're looking at this year, though.
Why do you think it's such a significant gap?
Well, we have had an influx of population into the town, and COVID is related to COVID. A lot of people moved in from out of state, and we weren't really prepared for the numbers that came to town and the needs that they came with them. We have a large increase in special education students, and it's our job to take them in and to educate them to the best way we can, and it's expensive to do that.
You know, Mike, you're a teacher in Stratford. What do you teach? Do you mind me asking?
I don't mind. I'm a high school English teacher at Stratford High School.
Okay. So in your professional opinion, what do you feel is lacking in Stratford when it comes to education?
Staff. Absolutely staff. My class sizes are very high this year, and many others are. And at the high school level, it means one thing, but elementary teachers are reporting the same thing in their classrooms. And young students need a great deal of attention, and it's not, we can't get the job done with the numbers that we have now. A status quo budget would have been acceptable but not ideal, and what passed last night out of the Ordinance Committee is not even a status quo budget.
Thoughts before we go into that meeting tomorrow night, do you think that they are going to give it the stamp of approval?
That is generally what happens. Generally what gets passed out of the Ordinance Committee is passed by the full council. It is the budget that was proposed by the mayor. And as you noted, it passed along party lines, and I would expect it to pass tomorrow night. I'm concerned about it, but that's my expectation.
Mm-hmm. Mike Fiorillo, anything else to add before we go into tomorrow night? Is there anything that if there are Stratford parents or teachers or anybody listening this morning who want to be able to have their voices heard, is there still an opportunity to do so?
Absolutely. Please contact the members of the town council and the mayor. We had a number of parents and students last night. Yes, teachers were rallying, but it was not only teachers. There were local officials and there were parents and students. When my students spoke, I was very proud of them for that. It's not too late. Yes, we would love to see your support.
Mike Fiorillo, we really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Mike Fiorillo is the president of the Stratford Education Association and also a high school teacher in the town of Stratford. And as I mentioned, this decision is going to go now to the board. They're going to be doing a council, I should say. The council is going to be voting on this tomorrow at 5:30 because there has to be a budget presented by Thursday, passed by the council. So we'll see what ends up happening. But again, there are some concerns about not only with this proposed budget, with the gap that is being presented right now, there are concerns about teachers or other administrators, staff members being cut from the district up to 35 is what we're hearing. Potentially a school closing, that's on the table, even programs being cut. So if you want to get involved with this, please be sure to reach out to the mayor, to the council members in Stratford. This is an ongoing a debate right now, I should say, in Stratford until that meeting wraps up tomorrow evening at 5:30. There have been recent reports that hepatitis cases, especially among young children, are on the rise here in the United States. And it looks like one of the 10 states where we're seeing that uptick in cases is right next door to us in New York. So joining us this morning is a family medicine practitioner, Dr. Miriam Syed, who recently began seeing patients at a new Hartford Healthcare location on the Post Road East in Westport. And we want to talk a little bit about these hepatitis cases. Good morning, Dr. Syed. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. So why the uptick in cases? Granted, I know it's not happening technically here in Connecticut, but why, in your professional opinion, are we seeing this happening across the nation?
So, this is a very interesting thing that we're seeing across the nation and actually across the world in some sense. But right now, we don't really know why we're having this uptick. So far, what we have determined is a majority of these cases, actually pretty much all of them, there has been a positive of adenovirus in these patients. So adenovirus basically is a virus that causes your common colds and sometimes gastrointestinal infection. And that has been found in most of these patients to be the potential culprit. However, that's still under investigation, and we don't really know if that is the actual cause.
Okay. So how common is it for kids to contract this? Because that was the other alarming part of this information, was that it seemed like a lot of kids under the age of 6 were the ones ending up in the hospital.
Yeah, right now it's not a cause of alarm because still remains to be pretty rare among children. I think the last count up until yesterday, we were a little over 100 in the entire nation, which is a lot because it is, it's kids. We don't even want even one kid to be sick. But if we look at the broad perspective of things, then it's still pretty rare. The reason why and the what we have sort of deduced at this point, where it seems to be more kids rather than adults, is adenovirus is actually more common in children, causes their, common cold. And we see the kids having runny noses every other day because they're exposed to other kids. So we're assuming the reason why it's affecting the children more, it's because they generally are more prone to adenoviruses.
Okay. We're talking this morning to Dr. Syed, and we're understanding a little bit more about hepatitis. What is it for anyone who's not familiar with hepatitis? Because it's not something you hear about too often.
Yeah, hepatitis is basically liver inflammation. That's the general, hepatitis is a general term, which means liver inflammation. And there can be several causes of hepatitis. We can get hepatitis in adults as well as children, but like I said, it is very rare in children. Most common causes of hepatitis is usually viruses, which is hepatitis A, B, and C, which you can get with different modalities. It can also happen due to certain toxins. Alcohol can also cause hepatitis, certainly overdose. Doses of certain medications can cause hepatitis. And there is one more hepatitis, which is usually autoimmune, meaning your own body attacks your liver cells, which can lead to hepatitis as well.
Yikes. How common is the last one, the autoimmune?
It's not very common. It's not very common. We obviously have to think about whether whatever is happening right now with children, if there is a potential component of autoimmune being there, and all of that is being investigated. But it is not something we see very commonly. Most of the common causes of hepatitis is usually the viruses A, B, or C.
Now, is hepatitis something that is underreported? Or the reason I ask that is because it is kind of bizarre that only 10 states have seen an uptick. Like, why hasn't Connecticut when we're right next door to New York?
Yeah, it can be underreported because sometimes the symptoms can be very mild. So the symptoms of hepatitis can mimic your typical stomach bug. So you can have just abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and some people may resolve on their own, which is why in certain cases it may be underreported. Certain viral hepatitis are supposed to be reported to the Department of Health. So once, you know, once it's diagnosed by a clinician, and it has to be diagnosed with blood tests. Once it's diagnosed, then it will be reported, and that's when, you know, the health department would know. But unless you seek care of the doctor, we will not really know whether you have had hepatitis or not. Some people may think they have had the stomach bug, and if they haven't really had the blood test to confirm and the symptoms resolve, we may not know.
And what are some of the, I know you said some of the symptoms, you know, but what are some of the cures for it? Because you said sometimes some people can just heal it on their own, but other times, like I'd mentioned, sometimes you end up in the hospital.
So the cure is highly dependent on the causes of hepatitis. So certain viral, if it's viral hepatitis, usually it has to run its course. Hepatitis C, there has been advancements in science in recent years, and we have found there are medications now to treat hepatitis C. Hepatitis A and B, usually they are viral and they have to run its course. If your hepatitis is secondary to medications or toxins or alcohol, then the treatment would be targeted more towards the cause rather than having one specific tablet or infusion that will treat all of hepatitis.
And we're talking again this morning to Dr. Syed. Dr. Miriam Syed is here, who actually just started seeing patients at a new Hartford Healthcare location in Westport as a family medicine practitioner. So what should people know this morning? What are some things that we can actively do to protect ourselves from hepatitis? I mean, I would imagine vaccination is one thing, but what else would you recommend?
So vaccination certainly is very important. There are vaccines for hepatitis A and B, which everybody can get, and you can contact your primary care practitioner for that. It's widely available everywhere. For this, I do want to point out that for this particular hepatitis, the one that is more prominent in children, it would be a good idea for parents to watch for any particular symptoms in their children, mainly if they're complaining of abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, as I've mentioned before. Again, but those can be signs of regular stomach bug. So sometimes we may not pay attention to those that closely. The biggest thing to watch out for, and the worrisome sign which should make you seek care immediately, is yellowing of the skin or eyes, which is the symptom of jaundice, which is basically jaundice, or if you're getting dark-colored urine or light-colored stools. Those should prompt you to seek care immediately because that can mean worsening of the liver condition. And since we have determined that this, since we have sort of been determining that this is likely due to adenovirus. Like I said, adenovirus causes common cold, GI symptoms, things like that. So the main thing to do is what we have already been doing with COVID. Wash your hands, make sure you're not touching dirty surfaces. And if you are going to be outside, make sure you're washing your hands and maintaining proper hand hygiene.
Really great tips. And Dr. Syed, really quickly, I'm curious, does a lack of vaccinations have anything to do with the uptick we're seeing across the U.S.?
I don't think we know the answers to that yet. I think every possibility is being explored at the moment. Most children, hepatitis B is part of their routine vaccination. Okay. So, if you are vaccinated for your routine vaccines as a child, you are covered against hepatitis B. Hepatitis A is sometimes optional, especially in certain states. So your child may or may not be vaccinated against hepatitis A. But so far, we have determined that this strain of hepatitis is not due to hepatitis A or B. So, it's important to be vaccinated because you want to protect yourself. But mm-hmm. at this point, we don't really know if vaccinations would help with this for sure.
Okay. Dr. Syed, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So what do you think? Would you rather have a safer car or would you rather just have someone do the work for you and have a self-driving car? This is something AAA is looking into, and joining me now is Fran Mako to look at the difference between safer cars or investing more in self-driving vehicles. Good morning, Fran. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate
it. How is everything?
Well, other than my phone freaking out, I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for asking. I don't know. That was so weird. That was so bizarre. Anyways, I appreciate you being here. So let's talk about this look at what consumers would rather see. In your professional opinion, what do they prefer? Having a safer vehicle or having more of an investment in self-driving vehicles?
Well, based on these studies that AAA has been doing, and when I say AAA, it is basically the national office, and we have a big research center way in California, and this is the third in a series of tests that they've done on the new technologies in cars, all these new technologies like the rear cameras and the blind spot monitoring mm-hmm. and the gadgets that keep you in lanes. They are the basis. They're laying the foundation for self-driving cars in the future. And in these studies, more and more drivers want manufacturers to improve existing safety technologies. They don't want manufacturers to go ahead and develop self-driving cars. The public generally is very fearful of self-driving cars. They're afraid to get into them. When I have my classes and we discuss the new technologies in vehicles, a lot of people go, "Oh, I'm not getting into a self-driving car."
Mm-hmm.
And most of these folks are baby boomers. And I use the term loosely. They're a little older. They really do not want to even try it. On the other hand, the millennials, the Gen X's, the Gen Y's, they embrace this technology. But unfortunately, based on studies that we've had, the technology is not there yet. In this particular test, we found that 77% of consumers do favor improving the existing systems rather than having manufacturers just go, full force ahead to develop a self-driving car and sell them.
So Fran, what do you mean by that? When you say that they'd rather see more improvements, like making the car safer, like what are they looking for in comparison to a self-driving car?
Well, what they did is in this particular test, there are certain technologies in cars right now.
Mm-hmm.
One is called lane positioning. You will know it if you have it, and if you read your manual. You're on the road, your car drifts out of the lane. The car automatically will bring you back. Sometimes the car will do it automatically. Sometimes it'll give you an alert, and you have to physically turn your steering wheel. That's lane positioning. Some other cars can follow the appropriate following distance of the car in front of you. And when the car in front of you slows down, your car will automatically slow down.
Oh, okay. All right. So they're still kind of smart cars, but you are still in the driver's seat is what you're saying.
Yes. In certain cases, in a lot of the more expensive cars like Teslas, some of the stuff is automatic. But based on these tests, I think they tested a Subaru Forester, a Santa Fe, and a Tesla Model 3. The performance was very spotty. It didn't work most of the time. And it crashed. The test cars, they crashed into, it's a dummy car. It's made out of foam. It travels. They have a dummy bicyclist. The systems in the car did not work consistently. So
yikes.
Based on that and based on surveys of the public, consumers, we're not there yet. We're not there yet with self-driving cars. And unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, depending on your point of view, consumers are very, very fearful even getting into a self-driving car.
I'm surprised that that's really more geared towards boomers. And the reason I say that, and granted, I don't make up a lot of the millennial population. I'm only one person. But most of my friends and a lot of the shows that we watch, like there's this one show that we watch on Hulu, Upload, and the kid actually, he passes away. I mean, it's a funny show, but the kid in the very beginning, he passes away. The main character passes away because he's in a self-driving car, and the car was manipulated by somebody to crash on purpose. It's a whole thing. But anyways, a lot of people in my generation, at least who I speak to, have no interest in getting in a self-driving car. Like, maybe I would try it if I'm fully alert and fully aware and awake, but I think my biggest fear, Fran, is I don't want to fall asleep in a self-driving car. I that just sounds horrific. terrifying.
Think of the possibilities, though. If everybody was in a self-driving car, there would be no more distracted driving crashes, no more drunk driving crashes.
True.
I mean, folks who in wheelchairs are,
can't drive now
mobile.
Have the ability.
They
yes,
have a
that's
way
true.
To get to wherever it is
that's
they,
true.
They're getting. But we're not there yet. I don't even think I'll see it in my lifetime. And these people that were surveyed, they're telling manufacturers, pull back.
Well, because the other thing, too, with that,
existing now.
I agree. And the thing with that, what you just said, Fran, that's interesting, is I'd feel more comfortable if the whole world had them. You know,
yes,
like if it was only some
how
of us,
work.
Yeah, that's how it would work. Exactly. If everyone was self-motivated or automated cars, fine. I'd feel much better because I know that everyone's on the same page. But if you still have reckless drivers, then no, that would make me very nervous.
So anyway, more of the key findings, a good chunk of folks, about 85%, said they would never, ever put or they'd be very uncomfortable to use a self-driving car to transport their kids. That makes sense if you're
110%
to one.
I agree.
They would prefer, instead of these self-driving cars and more advanced technologies, that manufacturers improve fuel efficiency, especially now with the high gas prices.
Yeah, amen to that.
But on the other hand, think about this. Nearly half said they're comfortable in riding in people movers, like the ones you have down in Disney.
I was going to say, I love the people mover. That's like one of the most popular rides at Magic Kingdom. I love the people mover.
You know, or going to an airport. If you go, I think it's an Atlanta airport, they have the shuttles, the automatic, I don't know what they're, trains and with the robotic voice.
Oh, yeah, those are great, too.
From one end to the other.
Yes, those are
so
great,
people,
too.
People are not fearful of that. They, and those are self-driving. Those are self-driving mechanisms, self-driving.
I guess because it's a controlled
vehicle.
Track, it's a controlled area versus just out in the world. I don't know.
Probably.
We're chatting with Fran Mako of AAA about, would consumers rather ride in safer cars with smart technology or self-driving vehicles? And Fran's basically saying we're just not there yet for the self-driving vehicles, but we're kind of moving closer and closer to it. So, Fran, what are some takeaways from this? You know, what can we look forward to, I guess, in the near future, since self-driving cars just don't seem to be in the foreseeable, in the very, very soon foreseeable future?
Well, excuse me, I think manufacturers will continue to put a lot more technologies in their cars to help people just remain mobile. I mean, there is a lot of items in cars that manage your speed, maneuver you on the roadway. I mean, we all have the rear view cameras that are now standard, the blind spot monitoring that tells us that there's something in our blind spot, we're probably going to see a lot more refinements like that. And there are a lot of reasons why consumers just don't embrace self-driving cars. I mean, this attitude has been unchanged for the last 3 or 4 years, and it's mostly because you're expecting people to embrace a technology that they have little or no exposure to. How can you be self-accepting of something you've never, ever tried? You know, and once people try, you know, ride in a self-driving car, perhaps their attitude will change. I mean, very few people have even seen one, and the only ones that have been on the road are pilot testing. And they didn't do very well. I mean, I don't know if you remember the story about the Google car.
Oh, I do.
They launched that, and it crashed into a truck on its inaugural voyage. You know, another
that
one, there was a person in the car, and she was distracted, even though the car was self-driving, and the car didn't recognize a pedestrian stepping off the curb. So there's a lot of work yet. And what consumers are saying, forget that. Focus on fuel efficiency, focus on safety features, and it will, you know, self-driving cars will eventually occur, but I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime.
I mean, and the other thing, too, is making it affordable. You know, when you talk about the self-driving cars, I think about just electric vehicles and how, you know, there's such a push. But they're so expensive.
That's where we're going. It seems that that's where we're going. A few years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago, self-driving cars were the big thing. Everybody was talking about they're coming. And now they realize there's so much more research that has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So we're focusing, you know, on the manufacturer and the promotion and the marketing of electric vehicles because of gas prices being so high and emissions. You know, the bent now is toward cleaner environments. So within the next decade, we're going to see a lot more electric cars, and hopefully they, too, will be a lot more affordable than they are now.
If you could, Fran, would you want to see a world with self-driving cars? What do you think of them?
Would I? I think it would be awfully neat. I keep thinking about, and I'm probably dating myself, the Jetsons.
Not dating yourself at all. I love the Jetsons. Absolutely.
I would like to. I would look forward to it, but I think I'm the odd person out. I'm sure if you ask someone else in my family, my husband, he'd probably say, heck no, I like the control. You got to understand, some people just like driving, too.
Some people enjoy driving. Listen, if I never had to drive again, Fran, sign me up. You let me know where that signature is. I would totally be there with you. Like I said, I think my biggest concern is I would want to see the entire world do it together. I wouldn't want to be like a self-driver when you've got the crazy people on 95 in Merritt Parkway right now going 95. I'm just,
So we shall see. We shall see what happens.
We shall see. It's really interesting, though, Fran. I love this take. I love this idea. And I love this study. And I'm glad you shared it with us on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time.
There will be a lot more, believe me.
Oh, I look forward to it. Fran Mako, AAA, always a pleasure to have you on the show. You have a great
day. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Where are my animal lovers at? I've got another great opportunity for you this morning. The Maritime Aquarium is looking for volunteers to tag horseshoe crabs as part of an ongoing census of the animals in Long Island Sound. Joining me this morning with all the details is Education Supervisor at the Maritime Aquarium in Norwalk. That is Bridget Cervero. Good morning, Bridget. Thank you for coming back on the show. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
It's always good to hear from you, Bridget. So talk to us about the horseshoe crab. What is the goal of this?
Yeah, so the goal of horseshoe crab tagging, the project, Project Limulus, is really to just get a better understanding of the population of horseshoe crabs here in the Long Island Sound. And by tagging, we get a sense of, you know, how many we're tagging them, where we're tagging them, and what. So we look at things like gender and size and their shell condition and collect all that information when we're out there.
Are horseshoe crabs an overpopulated species? Are they in any kind of danger? Or are they just sitting pretty? What do you think?
Well, this horseshoe crab population lately has been in decline, especially here in Long Island Sound, making this work even more important to keep an understanding of what's going on.
Why have they been in decline? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a few reasons that are potentially affecting their status. Things like pollution, loss of habitat, potentially getting tangled in gear. So it's a combination of things that's potentially affecting their population right now.
Is this the first time, Bridget, that we've done tagging for horseshoe crabs specifically?
No, the aquarium has been assisting with this effort, which is run by Sacred Heart University for many years. And the project's been going on for over 20 years now, and which is one of the great things about it. By being able to collect this information over a long period of time really helps you to visualize and see the trends.
I mean, tell us, Bridget, 20 years, that's a lot of time, a lot of work and data that's been collected. What have been sort of the trends for horseshoe crabs in Long Island Sound? What have you found that's really fascinating to share?
So I would say that, only speaking from our data, which is where we tag at Calfpasture Beach in Norwalk, we've been fortunate that we tend to use up all our tags every year, which is great. We tend to see a lot more males than females. One thing we also tend to see is, how they're coming up on the beach, which means they're either coming up as a single male or a single female, or sometimes we'll see them in what are called mating chains, where it might be a female with 1, 2, 3 males all kind of hitching a ride, hoping to fertilize the eggs. But I would say, incidentally, that I haven't seen as many of those change, so to speak, a lot more of singles or just pairs. So that's just, without looking at the data and really analyzing it, that's the first thing that comes to my head.
Interesting. We're talking this morning to Bridget Cervero, who is the education supervisor at the Maritime Aquarium at Norwalk. And the aquarium is inviting volunteers to join the staff in tagging horseshoe crabs. This is part of the ongoing census that's been going on for about 20 years now for Long Island Sound and these crabs, and just seeing how their population numbers are and things like that. So if I wanted to volunteer, Bridget, who are you looking for? First of all, what do they have to do? But also, who is an ideal candidate for a volunteer?
So really, anyone's able to come out and join us. This is open to all. Families come out. The biggest challenges to do it are, one is the timing. We go out to tag horseshoe crabs right around midnight in the late spring and early summer. And that's because that's when they're coming out typically to lay their eggs. That's when you get these large group coming up onto the beach. So you need to be able to stay up late to be able to get out there with us. And there is a little bit of a walk associated with it. But other than that, anyone's welcome to join. For any of our younger guys, they just need to be accompanied by an adult. So anyone 18 years or younger need to have an adult or a teacher with them. But we get a great variety of folks that come out. We have a lot of families, we have individuals, and what's great is we have people that have been helping us out for many years, which is nice, community of taggers that we have.
What an amazing experience. I think that's so neat to be out at midnight. And first of all, how do you tag a horseshoe crab?
So the tags are really quite simple. They're just little discs of essentially all-weather paper with a little bit of information. It's got an identifying number, and information about what to do if you find a tag, because that's really an important step to this study. And when we get the horseshoe crabs from the beach, we again collect that little bit of data, their size, their gender, what their shell looks like. And then we use an awl, which is just a little small tool, and we pierce a small hole in the side of their exoskeleton. And then we put that tag in and set them right back to the beach.
Okay, and obviously because it's their exoskeleton, they don't feel it or anything, right? There's no, obviously.
Yeah. It's not invasive, and we place it just in the right spot so it doesn't affect their mobility.
That's great. And these tags can withhold, like, being in the waters and everything, that they're fine?
Yeah, absolutely. They will stay on the horseshoe crabs typically as long as the horseshoe crab has that exoskeleton, meaning that if they molt or grow out of it, they'll grow out with that tag. and they'll be on there for many years. And that's a really important part of this study as well, is not just the act of tagging, which is really helpful, but also reporting if you see a tagged horseshoe crab. That kind of closes the loop. We know where we tag them, but then when people find them and report, you know, where it is, we'll have a sense of, you know, when it was tagged, when it was last seen, where it traveled to, what the shell looks like, if it's the same or different. So it's really awesome that people can get involved really in various levels with this project.
And we do know if you are interested in being a volunteer, you do have to sign up for one of the two evening trainings, which the first one's happening this Thursday, May 12th, and the other one is next Wednesday, the 18th. If people want more information, Bridget, and they want to sign up, where do they go?
Yeah, go to our website, maritimeaquarium.org, and then if you click on Community Science, you'll see an option there for all of our projects, including the horseshoe crabs, and you can follow the link to register from there.
All right. Helping and protecting the horseshoe crabs. I love it. Bridget, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.